figure Donald Campbell. 1967, the Bluebird, water speed record.
What?
Campbell died on his return run.
Yeah, but he died chasing a dream. Isn't that the way to go?
I'd rather not go at all.
It's called the James Bond Lexicon, and it has been researched, prepared, edited by Alan J. Porter and Gillian J. Porter, who are both with us this evening, live from Austin, Texas. Good evening, Alan and Gillian.
Good evening. It's great to be with you guys.
Nice to be here.
Yeah. Well, long-time listener, first-time caller. Is that what they say on the radio?
Yeah, I handle the... you're quite active, Alan, on Twitter, and I'm 99% of the time the voice of the Twitter account. So, you know, we've chit-chatted a little bit over the past, I don't know how long, couple years, I suppose. So it is nice to actually speak to you and to Gillian, of course, as well, since you're also a very important participant in the creation of this encyclopedia. This one right here, which was released at the time of this recording, and we'll try to do a quick turnaround with the editing on this one. But at the time we're recording, about 3 weeks ago, it was early April, first week of April, I think it was.
Yes, it was a special day, Jill will tell you.
April 6th. Was my birthday.
April 6th.
Oh.
Well, that was, you know, in some cultures, Jill, it is the person who's celebrating their birthday, excuse me, that gives something to the other people. Clearly, you are part of that culture, which we appreciate very, very much. So we'll get into the book, this encyclopedia, this tomb of James Bond knowledge, but I guess
at times it felt like a tomb. I will tell you what's really.
Oh, did it? Oh, geez. Well, I mean, and we'll get into that. You know, I know it certainly wasn't prepped in a weekend, a plethora of reasons, I'm sure, for why that was, and we'll get into those shortly. But maybe let's backtrack a little bit, since your first time on the show. Maybe your backgrounds with Bond, why Bond. And they will segue slowly into maybe the podcast. I know you co-host the podcast, which I'm a big fan of. But maybe let's start with the Bond background.
Well, let's start with me. I've told this story a few times, but basically my first introduction to Bond was the Triang Thunderball game in the UK, which the one with the little plastic frogman, which friend of mine had, I think, for his birthday. I seem to remember I was over at his house during the school holidays, and we just played it incessantly, and I had no idea who this character James Bond was, but he had the coolest figure on the board game, with a big jet, what looked like a jetpack on his back and stuff. And I must have gone on and on about James Bond, because that Christmas my parents got me the Corgi DB5 and a James Bond annual, which was pretty cool. But then, and I'm going to give my age away here, I won a competition in the local newspaper for two tickets to the local cinema, and decided to take my father to go and see James Bond in Honor Majesty's Secret Service, who, of course, was a completely different James Bond than the guy that was in the annual and all the photographs I'd seen, which confused me for a little bit. But about halfway through the movie, I will tell you the exact moment when the guy went under the snowplow, and he made the crack about he had lots of guts. That was it. I was hooked. I was a James Bond fan from that point onwards. And to be honest, for a long time, Bond was in the background. Batman was my big thing. Written a book about Batman. We had a big Batman collection. At one point, I was actually trying to pitch a book about Batman's co-creators. And I was talking to a publisher, and he was like, yeah, I'd like to read that, but I don't want to publish it. Have you got anything else? And right off the top of my head, I just said, well, how about a book about the history of James Bond in comics? Mm. And he went, okay, send me a pitch. And that turned out to be the first James Bond book that we did. And Jill played a big part in that as well, the history of the Illustrated 007. And that sort of introduced us to the folks in the Ian Fleming Foundation and into the Bond community as a whole. So over the past, I don't know, 10, 12 years since that book came out, sort of Batman went into the sidelines and Bond over as the chief obsession in the household, I guess. I'll let Jill tell her story. So.
I don't know. I don't have anything anywhere near as interesting as that. I mean, I just remember, you know, but growing up in the UK, there was always a James Bond movie on Christmas Day. Mm. You know, you'd watch The Queen and a music show, and then it would be James Bond. And it was just something that was always there. And then I met him, and, you know, I've been editing his writing for a long time, and it just gradually evolved into more. It was, you know, Batman, Beatles, and Bond for the longest time. And it gradually moved more and more over to Bond, and I was editing it, and it kind of pulls you in. And the Ian Fleming Foundation is very cool. And it gets you more interested in, you know, like more of the background stuff. And I think that's about it, really. I mean, I edited all his stuff, and when it came to be doing this one, he was like, well, do you want to fancy your name on the cover? You know, you do as much work as I do. And I thought that was really nice. I hated him for it at times, because at times it was like, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to play, but it was worthwhile. You know, it's been worthwhile.
That's why his books are so well written. You're mm-hmm. the editor. I see. I got it. You both just mentioned something that I know me and Matt are somewhat familiar. We have sort of a general idea of what the Ian Fleming Foundation is, because I know you've mentioned it a few times on Her Majesty's Secret Podcast.
Very polite there.
Nevertheless, since it's your first time on our show, and to be fair, I've sort of lost touch a little bit with what they do. Maybe just a drive-by version. What is the Ian Fleming Foundation? How did you guys get in touch with them, and what do you guys do for them or with them?
With them, yeah. Okay, so the Ian Fleming Foundation is a charity organization here in the US. Designed to promote cultural awareness of the works of Ian Fleming in literature and movies. And as part of that, we actually fund some scholarships in literature at a couple of American universities through the foundation. Mm-hmm. So that's the formal stuff. The cool stuff is that we also rescue and restore James Bond movie vehicles and props. Part of the reason we do that, one is to rescue them and preserve them and build an archive of Ian Fleming and the movies and stuff. And a lot of the ones from the early movies before Eon realized what they had were just either let go, destroyed, left to rot, given away to people, ended up in the weirdest places. They sort of loaned out to other folks, like the Bond in Motion exhibit that just finished in London. 19 of the vehicles that were there were Ian Fleming Foundation vehicles.
Oh, really?
So now, currently, I think as of today, because we've got a couple of recent acquisitions, I think we got 35 vehicles in the collection. And then, as I said, we got props and a lot of archive stuff as material as well. So how do we get involved? That was Raymond Benson's fault. I mentioned the other book, The History of the Illustrate 007. I ended up doing a co-book signing with him at a bookstore in Houston, Texas, when that came out. Raymond was very gracious enough to let me basically sit on the end of his table and bask in his glory and do a book signing. And we got talking, obviously, and over dinner later at Chewy's, by the way, which is a Austin Tex-Mex restaurant chain that James Bond eats in a Raymond Benson novel. Or was that one of your questions for later? But anyway, we were eating having dinner with Raymond, and he was like, well, you know James Bond, and you like James Bond stuff, and you clearly like cars and vehicles and stuff. He's like, there's some guys you should meet. And he introduced us to the James Bond, the Ian Fleming Foundation. What do we do? Basically, twice a year, we head up to the workshops and really just get down and dirty, helping to restore vehicles and props and stuff. It's hard work, but it's great fun. And sometimes you just have to pinch yourself and step back and look at what you're working on.
Unbelievable.
You know, I think the first thing I worked on was one of the stunt decoy models of the Aston Martin Vantage from The Living Daylights, the one where the skis come out. It's actually a fiberglass shell of the Aston Martin, but it's the one with the working skis. You plug an air thing in the back and the skis, not as smoothly as it looks on film, but the skis come out and go, you know. It's cool. We did some work on the cube boat. And there's a whole, and I just actually mentioned the Bondi Motion stuff. We're heading up there and now we're both fully vaccinated. There's a bunch of us who have all been vaccinated who are heading up there in a couple of weeks, because all the vehicles from Bondi Motion have arrived back at the workshops. So we've got to basically uncrate and check them and go over them and see what work needs doing and things like that. So we're going up there for a few days at the end of May. Which will be fun, because the last time we saw some of those was actually in Bondi Motion when we couldn't touch them.
I was at Bondi Motion a good few years ago at this point. And I mean, at that time, I don't think I was aware of the existence of the Ian Fleming Foundation, but it was a very, very cool, exhibit. I know, Matt, you didn't get a chance to go. That was actually one of our London plans. We had all things set up. Obviously, we're going back, 12, 13 months at this point. We had this whole thing planned, a week in London, and one of the things was a first-time visit for Matt at the Bond in Motion, and a revisit for me for the first time, and I guess it would have been 5 years about. Great. I remember I didn't know it existed, and I'm with my friends walking. I can't remember what street it's on, the Film History Museum or London Film Museum, something like that. And my friends knew that I really like movies. And so we're walking in the street, fairly rainy day. It's London. What else is new? And someone said, look across the street. There's a movie museum. You'd like that stuff, right, Edgar? Yeah. Okay, just give me 2 seconds, guys. Let me cross the street. And it's not just a film museum. It's Bond, James Bond vehicles. Guys, give me 10 hours.
I'd actually, because they'd moved, put new stuff in the No Time to Die vehicles, I was planning on doing it when I was in London for a business trip in March 2020.
Right.
And I overslept, and basically I didn't have the free morning I thought I was going to have on that trip. And it was a very quick in and out speaking engagement trip. I was only in there for a few days and I'd sort of lost that half day. And it was like, it's okay. I'll visit. We were due to go back to the UK later in the year. It's like, I'll stop by, later on when we're back in the UK. And of course, never did. So
that's a bit of a shame, especially since we have not gotten to see the film, and yet they included vehicles from the film, and now the exhibit no longer exists. That's a bit of a,
It's
not like for sure it'd travel. They would bring it elsewhere, but apparently
I don't know. So
strange, but anyways, on to happier things. You also co-host Honor Majesty's Secret podcast. Sometimes you're on the at first rookie agents, now rogue. They went from rookies to rogues like really fast. They must be big Daniel Craig fans. And you're also doing the regular episodes, or regular sort of the movie review episodes with Van Plexico, who's also an author, as I learned. How did that come to be?
Actually, Van and I think we met at a pulp writers convention, because we both write pulp, not fiction, historical sort of adventure fiction. He does science fiction. We met there and then on Twitter, and I don't think we'd ever talked about James Bond, and we actually bonded over Formula One racing.
You bonded over it?
Yeah, very good. we got to know each other. We both have a shared passion for F1. And then on Twitter, he mentioned something about James Bond, and it was like, didn't realize you were James Bond. And he was like, and we started doing a racing podcast, a podcast about Formula One and IndyCar racing. And it's like, let's do something with James Bond. And at that point, I worked out that if we did one a month, we could cover all the movies and just finish just before No Time to Die came out. Or Bond 21. So it's like, we've got 2 years, we'll do one a month and we'll be just perfect. And of course, but from that Van already had his own podcast network called White Rocket Entertainment, where he does a lot of pop culture stuff. And then we spun the Bond one off on its own network. And as you say, we've got two extra shows. We've Got the movie reviews, which we've finished, other than No Time to Die. And we're doing like fill-in shows. We're doing things around other films that the Bond actors have done. Mm. And then we have the soundtrack show.
Right. Best of the six.
Six of the best.
Six of the best. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I do with Jared Albrecht. And we are, again, rapidly coming towards the end of that. We're going to we're gonna record the Spectre show tomorrow. We're already thinking what we're going to do to fill the gap.
Oops.
And then, as you said, there's the Rookie Agents, which was completely Jared's idea. He basically got two of his friends who had never seen a Bond movie, and they would sit down and watch it for the first time with him and his brother, and then they'd do a show about their reactions to it. And they went through all 24 as well. And then when they did it, they graduated to become rogue agents, where they'd talk about odd, weird James Bond-related stuff. And I occasionally, as you said, occasionally join in that show, particularly if it's something about Bond comics or something like that. So, yeah, we do. At the moment, I think part of the problem, we had a very regular cadence until basically, Eon ruined it for us by keep moving the show, moving the movie. And now we're trying to fill in the gaps as to what we're going to do. So we're not quite as regular with the shows as we were, but we're still working on stuff and thinking through ideas for new shows as well.
It's an interesting time to be a Bond fan. There's no question about that. You know, there was all that anticipation. And we don't want to derail the tonight's episode, but you know, there was that whole anticipation. We were all getting ready. Some of us had travel plans. Others had local party plans. And, you know, for reasons obviously far beyond Eon's control, the rug was pulled from under everyone's feet. And now it's been, okay, let's pick up our bootstraps and let's create content. I mean, here at the James Bond Complex, me and Matt, we're just farting out ideas left and right. So we've survived. But yeah, you know, there's also that fun, like, yeah, it would be kind of fun to finally review this stupid movie one of these days.
Yeah, I think I saw something the other day that it's like 2 years since they did the press launch at Goldeneye. And it's like, oh,
that's right. Because they'd just done that
before we went
just
to
before because we went to Goldeneye October 2019. And they had just done it. And when we got a tour of Ian Fleming's villa, the lady was talking about, you know, that, yeah, talking about, you know, Daniel Craig slept in this room and, you know, they had a thing, they had a dinner here and they went down to the beach and you know, so that is funny to think that was so long ago, yet we still haven't seen the movie.
It is weird. I, you know, it's a good thing that I wasn't present at the time when they gave that tour that you're explaining, Joe, because probably when the guide said, you know, this is the bed Daniel Craig slept in. And now if you follow me into the other room, and I'd sort of let the group, you know, go, and then I'd sort of just crush it and smell the covers.
Just jump in the bed.
Oh, goodness gracious. Well, we'll all get to talk about No Time to Die at some point.
We have to talk about it for 2 years to fill in the 2 years.
2 years. You think it's going to be 2 years between No Time to Die and the next one? I hope so. But
we should have a James Bond podcast mashup of all of the James Bond podcasts, all joining together to talk about it.
We could do one of those things, what the JBR is doing, their birthday celebrations, and they'll spread it over like a month and a half, it seems. Yeah. But they'll get a few people per week. We'll do one of those things where it's like you, then Bill Koenig, then Mark Edlitz, then this, then that, David Zaritsky, and so on and so on, et cetera. We'll get there when we get there, as we like to say often on the show, but still have a little bit of patience left in the tank. Just a little bit of patience. There's still some there. Let's talk about a funny little book you guys wrote. The James Bond Lexicon. What would my first question be? What would our first... So when the devil possessed your souls and whispered in your...
That's an excellent word.
The spirit of Ian Fleming possessed your soul.
Yes. And whispered... What were those sweet nothings whispered in your ears that possessed you to say, you know what, this is a good idea. Let's make an encyclopedia.
Well, okay, that's all my fault. As Jill said, she hated me for it. I'm a big geek for these encyclopedia type books about fictional universes. I think the first one I ever got, was when I was at college, and I picked up the Dune Encyclopedia, which was actually an unofficial thing and is now out of print. But somebody actually did an encyclopedia of, at that time, what was just six books, the World of Dune. And that just blew my geek mind. I thought that was awesome. Then I found out, you know, somebody had written a Batman encyclopedia, and there was a Wonder Woman encyclopedia. And I've got, you know, we got now on the shelves, we've got those. We've got ones on Arthurian legends. We've got one on Greek myths and legends. And then a friend of ours, Rich Handley, had a publishing company, and God forbid, two of the first books he put out was a lexicon of Planet of the Apes and a lexicon of Back to the Future. I loved them, particularly the Planet of the Apes one, because I could never get that timeline chronology straight in my head, and it was like, you know, this is almost as confusing as Bond. So in a moment of weakness, I sort of said to him, hey, if you're doing this series, how about doing one on James Bond? And unfortunately, he said, yes, I'll publish it. and in my infinite wisdom, I said, well, that'll take us about a year, because that's about how long it took me to research and write the book on James Bond comics. Forgetting, of course, that comics is one thing, and when you add the movies, the novels, and everything, TV and everything else, that's a much bigger project. So, so that was 10 years ago, and here we are. The book has eventually seen the light of day, not just because of the amount of research, but a few other things as well. So
that's unbelievable. It almost sounds like you said in a moment of weakness, you said that there's almost another version playing in my mind where you're like, hey, wouldn't it be funny if I wrote this thing? And the managing editor went like, that's a great idea. Start working on it Monday morning. Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Well, we both read them. I mean, we have a Terry Pratchett one.
Oh, yeah. I forgot that. I contributed to the Terry Pratchett encyclopedia. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm a big fan of Agatha Christie, so anything. I've just finished reading the one about Poirot. So, you know, it's not just Alan that likes them. I like those things about fictional timelines too. So
there's an Agatha Christie, or there's an Hercule Poirot encyclopedia.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
Interesting.
It talks about all the books and then everything around it. It's really interesting.
Huh. I've had no idea. I knew there are a number of these, but
there are some Poirot fans out there. Oh, like, yes. Every fictional character has its own subculture fan.
Yeah, yeah.
It's fascinating. Like, everything has fans.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So part of this was, like we mentioned before we started recording, you mentioned the James Bond Encyclopedia. I have a copy of that on the shelf. A couple of copies. But there's some great encyclopedias of the James Bond, but they are just covering the movies. There's also a really good book that really examines the novels of Ian Fleming in real detail as well. If you actually ever want to know how to play that bridge game, I mean, he goes into like literal card by card. How to play the bridge game out of Moonraker. That's the one.
That's the one. That's out of print too.
Yeah.
Mine came with a Christmas, Merry Christmas. Not for me. But apparently Melanie loves me very much, apparently.
But yeah, so there's those. There's Jay Rubin's encyclopedia. There's that the one on Fleming novels. But as we would, you know, as Jill said, we read a lot of the stuff anyway. We did the book on the comics, and there was like, there's all these great characters in the comics that nobody really knows about. There's all the stuff in the Gardner continuation novels, the Raymond Benson continuation novels that people don't really know about. So that was the idea of the lexicon, was to try and pull things in from across the franchise into one resource.
It's quite incredible. And just out of curiosity, I mean, it's so detailed. Originally, what made you think you could pull it off in a year?
I must have been drinking some really good wine that night.
I was going to say a very large glass of wine.
I have no clue. I think I was just going on the fact that that's how long it took me to do the James Bond comics book. And we'd done a book on Star Trek in comics, and that took about a year. And I think that was just my baseline. And I'm like, yeah, that was...
I think we very quickly realized that it was going to be a lot longer than a year.
No kidding. And one of the interesting things, one of the many interesting things about the book is that when I started leafing, and Matt noticed the same thing as well, is that after a short, you know, very well well-edited introduction, there's a couple of pages that concentrate on continuity, which is a subject, a very funny subject to talk about in the James Bond fan community, as this introduction alludes to, for that matter. That struck me as very interesting. Why does the book begin with a brief discussion about continuity in James Bond? Why was that important for you guys? Why is it important for this book?
Partly because putting the book together and pulling the entries together, we had to make some continuity-based decisions as to how certain events affected different characters. Was that the same character? Was it a different character? Is it a different version of, you know? So I really wanted to explain that, explain my thinking. And I mean, the sum of that essay basically is, to an extent, continuity doesn't matter. But then it prefaces 430 pages of a book that is solely based on continuity. But my thing was not to get wrapped around the axle on it. You know, we made some decisions based on our interpretation. You're not going to agree with it. That happened the other day. Somebody made a quote from the book on Facebook, and boy, did it start a long thread. which got quite heated, but not pleasantly heated, but did get quite
heated.
It was partly really laying out our stall that yes, this is a book about continuity, but take it for what it is. Within the world of James Bond, there isn't a real hard and fast continuity. It's not like the Marvel Cinematic Universe or Marvel Comics. It's not like Star Wars, or, you know, where there's a defined timeline. You know, James Bond is a very loose, they're very loose within the movies.
Yeah.
Fleming himself contradicts himself all over the place. So, you know, don't get wrapped around the axle on it, but have a bit of fun. And, you know, and then, you know, yes, we made some decisions as we were going through. You don't agree with them, that's fine, but you know, this is just what we pulled together. So
is there stuff that you decided not to include in the book, or how do you make that decision to pick elements
that was a decision of if they didn't actually move, they were just somebody in there, if they didn't move that particular storyline forward, it was just like, oh, you know, Bond's cleaner came in the room. You know, she doesn't need to be in there. And initially we put everything in there and we're like, you can't have everything in there. This book would be like 5 volumes thicker than this one. You have to make a decision. And at the beginning it was hard, but towards the end you're just kind of like, yeah, don't want him. Don't, you know, you just got very...
She is ruthless. Oh yeah. She is ruthless. I think I lost almost every argument about whether somebody should stay in the book or not. She's a ruthless editor for the right reason. When we first printed this out, and it was single column, not double column like it is in the book, in the final book, but it was 750 pages when we first printed it out.
Wow.
we had to go through and be pretty ruthless. So.
I'm sure doing 2 columns per page helped a great deal. So it is a weighty. You know, I know it's fanciful and intelligent to go green. You know, get the Kindle version. This is one book where I'm extremely happy
you couldn't,
to not be ridiculous Kindle version. You need to excuse me. You need to leaf through this bad boy. It's incredible. I guess, I mean, there's so many entries. It's completely ridiculous in the best way possible, mind you. That's not a negative criticism, but it is a ridiculous book. What for each of you? What was the most difficult because everything is defined. There's a definition and an explanation for each of these terms. That's the point of the book. What was the most head-scratching or difficult definition to hone down for a particular word? Unless you both have the same answer, I don't know. The one that you're like, have it. No, it's not right. This is not, the readers won't understand it. It needs to be written like this. And
I think the hardest ones we ended up discussing between us, because what we would do anyway is, you know, one of us would read a book, we'd write our notes, we'd put it in, and then we'd edit it together. And if the other person was like, this doesn't make sense, I don't understand what this is about, then we would have, I can't remember a specific instances, but it was a joint thing of, you know, you'd sit there and you'd explain it, or if it was a comic, you'd say, just read this bit, because some of it you're like, I don't know what this person really was doing. It's important, but you'd read some of the comic strips and you'd be like, I have no idea what that story was really about, but you still have to pull the stuff out. Yeah, some of them were just
I would say some of the stuff from the Daily Express comic strips were probably
the hardest,
even though they probably got really small entries, because some of the time, as Jill said, that like somebody appears in a couple of panels, but they do something that moves the story along, but you don't know why, or it's like, well, who were they? And maybe they're not named properly, so you've got to go digging and find the name. So some of those were harder. I don't think there's actually like one that we ever really particularly sort of pulled our hair out over, despite this. I don't think there's anything that we actually pulled our hair out over. But
I was about to ask, is that what you have?
It turned my hair pink. It's really weird.
Same.
Obviously, one of the more lengthy definitions in this book is James Bond.
Mm-hmm.
You're writing a new encyclopedia. You're writing a lexicon. Obviously, James Bond is an entry that needs to appear. There are 28 versions of James Bond. Where do you start? Okay, honey, let's define James Bond for our lexicon. What's the process there?
I actually started at the beginning, started with Casino Royale, and built that as the Fleming, pulled the stuff in from the Fleming's books, and that was James Bond number one. That was a foundation. And then everything else was sort of from the novels, built on that. And then pretty much the same with the movies. You know, the only decision I think we made fairly early on with the movie Bond is there one James Bond? Is there six James Bonds? Is there two James Bonds? You know, and we were like, well, you know, doing the research, we found the quotes that when Lee Tamahori was wanting to make Die Another Day, and he basically said to Eon, can I make 007 a code name and this be a James Bond? And they were like, no, it's the same guy. And it's like, well, okay, if Eon says Pierce Brosnan is the same guy as Sean Connery, we'll take that as our baseline. So for us in the movie, the Eon movies, there's two James Bond, there's Connery to Brosnan, despite the flashback in Die Another Day that causes issues and stuff. And then there's the Daniel Craig Bond. So that's two Bonds. So again, you know, we've got our baseline Bond, and then we've got the additional ones, we've got the Fleming Bonds. The Horowitz stuff sort of fits in with the Fleming Bond, but the Gardner Bond is different, and the Benson Bond is different, and so on. And it sort of branches out, which is why that table is in the book. The table of the 28 Bonds is in the book, because I had to put a spreadsheet together to figure out which Bond is which. So
I just let him play on that. I was just like, why?
A little bit too geeky for my taste.
Yeah, I didn't care by that point. But I mean, in most respect as well, like, you know, Alan read the Fleming novels, I read the Gardner novels. So some of it was siloed as well, because he would be working on that and I'd be working on another one.
Interesting.
Which I think helped, because otherwise, if you were the person who read all of them, it would be much more difficult to parse them out. But because we split that down.
Interesting.
It made it different.
Is that what resulted in that not timeline, but that table, which is right after the chronology chapter that lists these 28 versions of James Bond, is that what resulted in there being, because I didn't even clue in on that, just as you were explaining that, I was like, right, there's a different entry as Raymond Benson's James Bond and there's Gardner's Bond. Is that what led to that decision, or did you guys always think it's a different Bond? Because I always sort of took those, and I think Matt, I don't want to put Matt words in Matt's mouth, you can correct me, but I think we always took that as, well, it's kind of like the movies. It's the same James Bond, even though we're settling in the 80s.
I'm terrible. Like, I've been dropping Raymond's name all the way through this, but I'm going to do it again. That's partly because of Raymond Benson, because he told us, I can't remember where, over drink somewhere, that basically when he got the gig, he was basically told to ignore the John Gardner stuff.
Really?
Yeah, and it's like, well, your Bond is sort of Pierce Brosnan's Bond. That's why there's a female M, but you can't use the movie stuff. But it has to be sort of contemporary, so that was sort of his marching orders from Ian Fleming Publications. That was already in our mind. But I think I've always thought of them as being different, you know, based on the Fleming Bond, but slightly different characters because they're contemporary. Right. And that's how Bond really works, is as a contemporary character. I mean, in the movies, I know, you know, lots of people are like, oh, why can't we do a period piece movie with Bond? I think Bond works best in a contemporary environment, moving through time. Sherlock Holmes is great, stuck in 1895. I know a couple of people, the Horowitz stuff works because he's fitting into the slots in the Fleming timeline, but I don't think I want to see a period piece movie, a James Bond movie.
A really interesting opinion.
Yeah, we don't agree on that.
That's interesting. It's not interesting it is interesting that you disagree, because I don't think I've ever actually given my a public opinion about this, but I feel I could be wrong. Maybe I'm reading the posts, I'm misreading the tea between the tea leaves, but I feel more people seem to agree with you, Jill. I'm hearing this a lot, like, oh, Netflix series, bring it back to the 60s, or, oh, this Daniel Craig stuff, it's too much of a structured timeline, Bond 26, bring it back.
I agree with that sentiment. I don't like, I don't like the continuity. I mean, for me, a Bond movie, whenever it's set, he should walk into M's office, throw his hat on the hat rack, get his, you know, Bond, this weird guy who's doing weird stuff, here's a folder, read it, or
go save the world.
Go save the world, and he goes off and saves the world. Ends up in a dinghy with the girl at the end of the movie. I'll be happy if that's Bond 26. I'll be happy.
So. Yeah,
let's hope so.
We'll see. We'll get through Bond 25. let's try to get through that one first. Then in 10 years from now, when they release Bond 26, we'll see what that one's about. But
I actually go back to your Netflix thing, though? What I would love to see is them spin stuff out into Netflix and actually start to treat Bond as a multimedia channel franchise. Keep the movies, the James Bond movies, as the big tentpole every 3 years. But do stuff in between, the video games, the comics, the books, and more books.
Animation.
Animation. I've said this, Dynamite Comics recently did a Tiger Tanaka Felix Leiter miniseries, 4 issues. I would love to see a Tiger Tanaka Felix Leiter buddy cop show on something like Netflix.
I was editing it this week. We just released our Ian Fleming's Casino Royale conversation with Bill Koenig. And he was saying, I don't know, we were just, you know, going crazy on that episode. And he comes up with the idea of like a one-off movie on Netflix where like Bond, Tiger, Felix, and Mathis are around the table playing poker and they're trying to out-cheat each other. And I'm like, that's brilliant.
Yeah. Oh, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
Stuff like that really widen the horizon.
Yeah, but yeah, video games, books, comics, animation, bring in the younger audience again.
And I think they could do it with the young James Bond books too. They could do some kind of, you know, a Netflix series around them. I mean, they're pretty vicious. But
we have someone on this show that's always interested in young Bond stuff, don't we, Matt?
Yeah, but it depends what kind of young Bond. You know, I love animation and I love teen spy. I have this, almost upset Edgar every time I talk about James Bond Jr. I have this fascination. I know it's not good, but it's just weird that they...
You can't beat a villain as good as Walker D. Plank. I mean, come on.
No. A pirate with a wooden link in James Bond.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah,
but I haven't watched the entire show. I was a kid when it came out, the first round. So I did watch them first run, a few of them. I don't remember any of them. We did an episode about 2 years ago, and you know, I watched more than Edgar did. Edgar watched, I think, one episode, and he was done.
Three.
I watched a few more, but you know, they're kind of fun, but at the same time, they're horrible.
They so bad it's good?
No. Just, okay. they're just bad, but it's so ill-conceived from the get-go that, you know, they're trying to appeal to kids, introduce them to James Bond, but yet they, for some reason, they forgot to make the characters that are in the movies look like they do in the movie. So it's like, you're creating this side character that appeals to no one. Like, adults are not going to recognize James Bond, and kids don't know who James Bond is. When they see the real James Bond, they'll be like confused and puzzled and not interested at all. The only one that looks tiny bit like he does in the movie, I felt, was Jaws, because, you know, he's big, he's tall, he's wearing a suit, but, you know, he talks. But it's just... what's his name? Nick Knack. Nick Knack, yeah. Looked at with a giant chin, and I'm like, did they get the? Couldn't they get the license from the actor? Is that why we got this thing as Nick Knack? Who's the lucky one who had to watch the cartoons more than once?
Me. I haven't actually watched any of them. I watched
all 65 episodes.
You've been saved.
Read all the novelizations and the 12 issue comic book series.
You know,
how do you feel?
Why do you think I'm drinking a large glass of wine?
I almost feel bad because I've read Mark's book, and the people that made the cartoon are really proud of it.
Oh. And
they did it with the best intentions.
Yeah, they really did. I mean, it's not very good, but it was generally made with genuine love. And there are the names of the Bongers are funny. I'll give them that. There are elements. There are action sequences that, if the animation was better, because I feel like the entire series is underfunded, and it was made what's his face that. Bought MGM in the late 80s.
The Italian fellow.
Yeah, the Italian fellow. And I think I read somewhere that all he wanted to do is use franchise that they had in the catalog and do cheap knockoff versions to generate money. And that's James Bond Jr. It's just a ploy to sell horrible toys. Even the toys weren't not that impressive. They were just, oh, I'm sorry. I just...
It's all right.
And I'm still fascinated by it.
I tell you, yeah, I watched all 65 episodes and I thought I'll never get through this. But I've actually grown to be, now I'm not actually deep in it, I'm actually sort of grown to be quite fond of it in retrospect. So,
You know what? I just said that to Edgar.
Yeah, I know.
I plan to watch the entire series. One episode per week.
Yeah, but you don't have a book to write. You don't have a book
but,
to write.
You know, it's bragging rights, Edgar. Yeah. Bragging rights.
Yeah.
Well, that's, I don't want to get too sidetracked, but again, this conversation is veering off into an interesting little side discussion. So you're saying that you had to do your homework for the lexicon. So you watched the episodes, you read the novelizations and this and that. Now you're saying, You're warming up to James Bond Jr. Considering how what seems like everybody seems to loathe that property. What is it about that version of James Bond that you are warming up to? I mean, seriously, I find this fascinating. I love it when these things happen in
I think it's partly what I said. I think it was done with the best of intentions. I think it's partly Mark Edlett's fault too, talking to Mark about it, reading the book.
Yes.
I think it was done with the best intentions. I think they were trying to do something that they should be doing now, which is, while there was a big gap in the Bond movies,
yeah,
I mean, that was this. It was an Eon production. A lot of people tend to forget that it was an Eon-backed production to appeal to young kids, to get them into the franchise while there was a hiatus between the movies. So I think it was done with that. Unfortunately, I think budget hit it. Some of the things in it are corny.
No,
the names are corny.
No,
but I don't know. I think it's. I think it's partly, I never watched it when it came out originally, so it was probably my first real exposure to it. So I wasn't coming at it with a kid's eyes. I was sort of coming at it with a very cynical adult eyes. And I think since then, I've sort of, the cynicism level has dropped slightly, and I've tried to sort of think about it in terms of, you know, what would it have been like as a kid? You know, if you think back to sort of the fact I became a James Bond fan at 10, if I'd have been about 11, 12, 13, and that was on TV, would I have watched it? Yeah, probably, and I'd have lapped it up. So, you know, like I said, I'm not going to run out there and say it's the best thing ever. I know I have some unpopular opinions, like I will back Casino Royale 67 till the cows come home. Yeah, I know, rolling your eyes, Edgar. And I've sort of grown to like James Bond Jr. a bit too. So maybe I'm just weird. I'm drinking too much of this wine or something. I don't know.
And I know that you don't dislike the film, but you're not too hot on Skyfall, which is another one that everybody says, oh, this is one of the best ones. It's one of the perfect. It's a good film, but it's not a good James Bond film. I think your review is like something to that effect.
Oh, no, I hate Skyfall.
You hate Skyfall.
With a passion.
And on that, we agree.
And we agree about that.
We'll get back to the book. Don't worry, guys. We'll get back to the book. So you don't like Skyfall either, Jill?
No, I don't particularly like Daniel Craig.
Okay. Let's talk.
I don't like the look they give him clothes wise. I don't like the fact that he always has to have so much dang angst about him. Yeah. He looks like, you know, his mom couldn't buy him the right size suit. I mean, come on.
Oh, that's a low blow, Joe. That's a
I'm sorry, blow. But it's an opinion I have. But I don't find that, you know, he gets called a blunt object. Blunt objects don't sulk and go boo-hoo, you know. And I don't like the way Eon have taken it, but I think Skyfall as a Bond movie just doesn't work. It just, to my mind, it doesn't work. I mean, some of the photography is fantastic. But no, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, the cinematography is great. The soundtrack's great. I quite like the opening sequence, partly for personal reasons, because of the caterpillar tractor in there, which I managed to get from the foundation. But my former caterpillar colleagues will kill me for calling it a tractor. Sorry.
They will.
If you really want to know why I don't like Skyfall, I have a 2-hour rant on my secret podcast about why I don't like Skyfall.
We'll put the link in the show notes.
Please do. Yeah. Yeah. I'm quite happy to share it around. It's not my bottom one. Spectre is my bottom one because Spectre, they just didn't try.
So Daniel Craig era for you guys.
Oh, Daniel Craig goes good. But Casino Royale's in my top three.
Casino Royale is an excellent movie.
Casino Royale's in my top three, and I appreciate Quantum of Solace too. But I think it's just been diminishing returns with Daniel Craig.
So the bar is low, but it's looking good for No Time to Die with the bar that low. It's looking good. You can't go lower than that.
No.
He's a good actor.
Yeah, I like him in other stuff, just not as James Bond.
Yeah, it's not the James Bond I like to see. But I loved him in Casino Royale. I thought there was very little you could criticize personally in that movie.
As James Bond is grown less and less human and barely talks now.
Jill, yeah, some of those lines in Spectre is a little it's not the sort of thing that would look good in a form. Like, he's almost not enunciating the syllables sometimes.
Yeah. You know, the whole story.
Yeah, Spectre for me committed the worst sin out of any movie, and it was boring.
That said a lot about Spectre. I will admit that I do enjoy it. I don't love it. It's got its share of problems. It doesn't end on a high note. That's for sure. But I did appreciate that it was the first time in the Craig era that, and I'm not saying it was a complete success, but it was the first time in the Craig era where they said, well, why don't we try to make him feel a little bit James Bondy? Give him some quips. Make him smile a little bit, make him dress up as a skeleton and say he won't be long. It's like, make him do James Bond stuff. So I was like, okay, I'll buy it, but it's not like a great movie. It's got one or two flaws.
That's a whole other podcast.
Oh yeah. we'll bring you back for our, we've done the original review, but we do reload it. So we reload a movie and we talk, well, maybe we'll bring you back for Spectre.
Or Skyfall. Skyfall could be a 6-hour one.
Jill, you did mention that you took care of the Gardner novels, and Gar and I I've been reading, but we stopped. I think we're halfway through is over. I'm a little bit worried because it's been sort of up and down with Garner.
Case in point, we suddenly decided to, you know what, let's read the Flemings again. But we're not done with Garner. Let's read the Flemings again.
There's some of them were pretty good, but others you just like, are you kidding me? They were books I wouldn't have finished if we weren't doing the book.
Yes, I agree. The one with the ice cream, I don't remember which one that is. I was okay. Now he's on. And what's happening? Okay. Felix Leiter is sort of giving away his daughter to James Bond. What am I reading? Oh,
God, that was creepy. Yeah,
that was not very good. But there's stuff like Icebreaker, which, you know, has a good plot, good villains, good Bond girls, and like a pretty solid torture sequence that I would put on par with some of the Fleming stuff. And then you have stuff like, I don't remember the title, but the one where all the hitmans are trying to get at Bond, which is a brilliant plot point. A bunch of hitmen are trying to kill Bond.
Yes.
But it's sloppy, and the Bond girls are interchangeable. That's my main complaint about the Bond girls. They're so interchangeable. Thank you. I'm messing up my English. But how many times did you have to read those books?
I don't know how Alan approached it. What I would do is I would read it just straight through, and then I'd go back through. And I'm not very good at making notes in books, like marks and stuff. But it got to the stage where you needed to, you know, like underline with a pencil or something, so that when you went back in, you could do that. And then I'd start making notes then, but I'd read it straight through once first.
Okay.
And I could say the best thing about some of those Gardner books is they were a fast read.
Okay. I suppose that's a positive. So you weren't too keen on the Gardner. And again, as Matt alluded to, we haven't finished them. We're about halfway through. And even then, we've taken what feels like a year-long hiatus at this point. What would you say is your favorite Gardner book?
I would say the Icebreaker one. I thought that was pretty solid.
That's the third.
That gets me worried now. I'm concerned.
There's a couple of others. I just, you know, we read so much, and then that was a while ago, and I've read a lot since then. I can't think of specific title names, but there were, I don't know. Talk amongst yourselves while I...
Out of the things you guys had to...
It's a good reference book here.
You're cheating.
I know.
Cheating.
It's great. It's fantastic. It's the book that keeps on giving. speaking of that research, what was maybe the things you guys thought, oh, this is going to be daunting? Was it the films? Was it the books? Was it the comic? I'm sensing maybe Alan, I'm guessing you tackled the comic books and you seem like a comic book guy.
No, we split the comics between us, actually.
Interesting. So was there one I'm certain you guys dove into the project with great enthusiasm. Nevertheless, it's a bit of a daunting challenge you guys gave yourselves. Was there one thing, oh boy, you know, those Bensons are going to be tough, or the Craig era is going to be tough? What was maybe the more challenging thing to broach for the Lexicon?
Actually, in some ways, I think it was the comics, because we'd already been through all the comics for the previous book with a slightly different eye. I mean, we'd been through them then from a historical, who wrote them, who drew them, when were they published, what was the plot line. We weren't looking at like individual characters, but having gone through them, you know, when we started this project only a few years before, you know, it was, we've got to go through them. So again, we split those, and Jill did some, I did some. So basically Jill did the ones that I'd already done in detail for the book. So okay. She was coming at them for the other book. So she was coming at them with a fresh
this
eye.
This book's rubbish. I can't find what I'm looking for.
I've lost my train of thought now.
Comics.
So Jill did the ones that I'd already covered for the previous book. So she did most of the Daily Express strips. And then I did some of the other stuff and the more modern ones, the Dynamite comics and stuff like that. So.
Yeah, those are great.
I think the only thing that I really got to, oh my God, I've got to go do this again, was the previously mentioned James Bond Jr. 65 episodes. As much as I've grown to sort of mildly appreciate it now, at the time, it was like, oh, I've got to go downstairs and plug into YouTube and watch another 3 episodes of James Bond Jr. tonight.
Not only that,
particularly as I was getting like really well into it, you know, like I was into the, you know, 40s, and it's like, how many episodes of this have we got to go? You know? So,
oh, that's fantastic.
But I will say that the real tough point was through the editing. There were times when.
Yeah, but she does that.
No, but when we were
we're doing it together.
When we were co-editing and going through and proofreading and stuff like that. There were evenings, you know, we were like, we will sit down and we will methodically do half an hour to an hour of editing each night after dinner.
Right.
And there was some nights when it's like, we just can't face it. We really just can't face it.
Take a night off.
Yeah. And sometimes that night off ended up being a week off. And then it was like, we've really got to get back to it.
These things happen. Were there some entries that, for each of you, was there an entry where like, we nailed it, that was a particularly satisfying entry, whether because it was difficult to find the definition and you finally cracked it, or because it was a particularly daunting one and when you reread it and edited, you said, that's exactly what this book needs. Is something that you really felt like you're very proud of this entry in particular?
Actually, for me, I think it's that in that James Bond, Ian Fleming one, is actually pulling all the pieces together into that, because particularly when you start, if you think about Fleming's Bond, you're not just talking about Fleming books, you're talking about the Horowitz books, you're talking about Colonel Sun, the Sebastian Foulkes book, it's written as Ian Fleming, so that's a Fleming book. So taking the bits and pieces that are in there and plugging those back into Bond's storyline and building basically his backstory, as much as I don't like Bond having a backstory, the backstory that sort of emerged by pulling all those clues that are scattered throughout all the Fleming era novels, and pulling that into a cohesive sort of biography for that baseline version of James Bond, I found quite satisfying. Yeah.
Awesome. Jill?
I think it's got to be the Moneypenny diaries.
Interesting.
Because there aren't very many of them, and trying to piece together enough information from those books was hard. I mean, we were very lucky in that a friend of ours had copies that he sent us, because we couldn't get them.
Yeah, they're tough to find, and I think they go for a pretty penny.
Yeah,
that was I didn't even do that on purpose. Pretty penny, but yeah, they're a little bit tough to find these days. Interesting. Did you enjoy those?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, it was just, you know, a different side to it all. Mm. But that I found, because it was so different from all the other Moneypenny's that I'd read about.
Is she the Moneypenny in the Fleming books, or is this like another version of It's another version of Moneypenny. Interesting.
Because books, she's barely a character from what I remember.
Yeah, no, she was pretty much, she had a good character in them, but it was, you know, trying to make her different without too different, I guess, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you raised a good point there. A lot of people think Moneypenny is from the Fleming books, and she's actually hardly in the Fleming books at all. She really comes from the comics and comic strips and then the movies, in terms of that relationship.
Yeah. She's more like Leela
Ponsonby is Bond's secretary who he flirts with and stuff like that. Yeah.
She's a combination in the movies.
Yeah. So I actually thought your proudest moment was the killer, either the killer ferret or the killer ape entries.
He said daunting.
Oh,
not daunting. Proudest.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
What is your proudest?
Oh no, I would say the funniest is when I was reading the comics, I was like, did you know they have killer ferrets? Or somebody had a trained killer gorilla, you know, and then we talk about it and giggle about it for a bit. And it kind of lightened everything because it was just so ridiculous. But I couldn't wait to write that one.
Some of those entries, I mean, when we chatted a little bit about this, I mean, it's in Mark Edlitz's most recent book, but we also had him on the show about a month or two ago. And we chit-chatted about that a little bit. And some of those, usually it would be like non-American, non-European markets, usually. Mm-hmm. And I haven't had the luxury of reading them or holding them in my hands, but there are sufficient descriptions in Mark's books about what happens in these stories. And it's like, what the hell is going on? Like, are we doing a James Bond story or Star Trek? What's happening?
Well, yeah. And you know, that was the problem, because like I said before, you read one and you'd be like, yeah. And now I have to write a summary of what that was about. And you're like, you know.
Good job.
Yeah. Some of them were pretty crazy, I will say.
Oh, I can imagine. Now, there's a very familiar name that appears on the back cover.
Oh, and, yes.
I'm not talking about YouTube. just very briefly, Pat Carbajal or Carbajal, I can't remember how his name is supposed to be pronounced, but the artist, I say familiar because I have, we own Mark's two previous books, Lost Adventures, Many Lives, and he, Mark waxed poetic about Pat's work, and I believe Matt as well. I mean, I was over the moon when I saw his name on the back cover, and frankly, I think we were on Facebook Messenger that night, just snapping pictures. Did you see this one? Did you see this one? So how did you guys get in touch with him, and how was that collaboration?
Well, I actually have a bone to pick with Edlitz over Pat's work. He knows this.
Saucy.
Yeah, so actually Pat had done the illustrations for the previously two mentioned lexicons, the Planet of the Apes and the Back to the Future ones, way back when, with our original publisher. And so when we decided to do the Bond lexicon, I reached out and said, can we get this same guy? He works great. Can we get him to do stuff? And Pat said yes. I didn't realize he was a big Bond fan. So basically I said to him, you know, can you do like one illustration for each letter of the alphabet and a couple of others, thinking we'd get, you know, 20, at least 26 and maybe 28, 30 illustrations. We got 80 illustrations back from Pat, and they all blew me away. So this was way back. This was 2015, I think.
Wow.
So we've actually had these illustrations since 2015. So when I actually met Mark Edlitz in New York, and he proudly showed me his book and flicked it out, and there's pictures, artwork by Pat. I said, you've stole my Bond artist. Because I always thought that our book would be Pat's first published Bond work. So, and Mark knew nothing about the fact that he'd been working on the lexicon, or had worked on the lexicon all those years ago. But
interesting.
So we've actually had these this artwork in the various files. As I say, back to probably 2014. So, they are absolutely amazing. We've tried to use as many as we possibly can throughout the book.
Oh, that was actually one of the questions I had in mind. I was wondering, did he draw anything that didn't make it in, or was there a decision making an editorial decision making procedure as to, well, you know, we don't need an illustration for that, although your picture's really nice and stuff like that. Were there any tough?
Not really. Like I said, you know, the original one was that we wanted one for each letter of the alphabet.
Yeah,
we
got more. Yeah.
And we got more than that, so it's like, yeah, I want to use as much as we can. I actually will give you an exclusive here, though. When we were putting the book together, I realized we actually didn't have one for the letter I. So if you wonder why the I section is a picture of Sean Connery sipping sherry and what that has to do with the letter I, it has absolutely nothing to do with the letter I. It's just we had a space, and I went through what we hadn't used and like, what would be a really good one to put as a there. So, and it's a really brilliant illustration of Sean Connery sipping sherry. Well, so, and he used a line in there about, there was a word he used that began with an I in that speech. And I thought, well, I'm putting it in there. So,
right. Well, you could also say that he has an intriguing look on his face.
Oh, he said it was a sherry of indeterminate age. So I thought, okay, well, he said I in there. So, that's a world exclusive for you. I haven't told anybody else that story. So.
Thank you so much. This is very, very lucky that this is why we bring guests on the show. It's for exclusives like this. Do each of you have maybe a favorite illustration of Pat's?
Hang on a second. We just got some.
Oh, sure. No worries.
Technical issues. Yeah. So sharing the headphones and we keep moving too far apart.
Social distancing.
Favorite illustrations. For me, I actually love the Money Penny one.
Damn.
But you was probably
yeah, that's
that. So, do you have anything else?
No, it was that one.
The one we've mentioned on the 00 Files guys when we were on there. Don mentioned that the Blofeld looks much scarier in the illustration than he does in the movie. And I would agree with that. He does.
True.
True. So yeah, the M one. I think. Excuse me. I'm going to have to flick through a book now, just to remind myself.
Yeah. I mean, there's the money. I'm looking at it right now. It is a very. She looks very. Apart from the obvious. Oh, she's a beautiful woman. She looks very. Professional. She looks very. I don't know. She looks military. There's like a military.
Looks like a portrait from those portrait photographs.
Yeah, I know. I probably M secretaries don't get their portraits hung up around MI6. But if Moneypenny had her portrait hung up, like this is what it would look like. Sort of. It's interesting. I noticed that maybe not literally every leading lady, but. I feel like virtually every leading lady gets their own portrait. And even then some of the supporting female characters would.
Well, I don't know if you follow Pat on social media, but he likes to draw the ladies.
I don't, but I clued in flipping through this book. I'll tell you that much. And I don't know how much we want to get into some of the creative liberties he takes, but I'm like, oh, that's, I don't remember her quite like that in the movie, but
yeah,
it looks good in the book.
I will say I actually showed the Octopussy one to Maud Adams several years ago before the book came out. And she was like, is that meant to be me? And I'm like, I think it really looks like you. But
are you serious? Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's a shame.
But
they're sort of the idealized.
Which
is the same.
There was one that was really. I wasn't expecting. Oh, the one I wasn't expecting was Peter Sellers, the Peter Sellers one as Evelyn Tremble, and that was I was just not expecting anything like that. And I thought that was pretty cool. So
Why not? Hey, I mean, he is one of the 28 James Bonds.
Yeah.
Gotta give him he's
one of the 28 in right, that movie.
Well, David right, Niven's David Niven's one of the 28, but
right. Yeah. Well, David Niven is the in that universe. David Niven is James Bond. Peter Sellers is the like new recruit James Bond.
And,
interesting. I keep wondering, is that the movie that made people talk about the code name theory? Like there can't, it's fairly early in that intellectual property's existence. I'd be surprised if there was anything prior to Casino Royale 67 that talks about a code name theory. I'm wondering if that's like the kernel.
I think that's the, there may be earlier mentions. I'm sure some Bond scholar somewhere will tell us where that first came up, but I think it's the one that really put it into the popular imagination type thing. So
another reason to hate that movie, actually. I will say this. I do very much enjoy the scene where Peter Sellers walks in. Is it Jacqueline Bisset is in the, is it Jacqueline Bisset? I can't remember.
Yeah, in with the champagne.
Yes, it's a, what year? Something a gag where he's asking about the champagne's year and she's actually given the age of like the porter she seduced to get in, and he's very good year, you know. That's pretty good. I had another question on the tip of my tongue and it has now escaped me. My apologies. But Matt, was there anything you wanted to get off your chest?
Right now, I'm stumped. All the questions, because we discussed, what type of questions we wanted to ask you guys about the creation of the book. But is there something that none of the people you talked to, I forgot to or didn't ask that you'd really like them to ask you? That is there a question that you haven't asked that you wanted to be asked?
Well. Not that I can think of off the top of my head. So, not necessarily a question, but you talked earlier about what do we leave out of the book, and we talked about editing. There is actually a whole section that we left out of the book, because when we first put the book together, there was actually a whole chapter with plot descriptions of every story.
Volume 2?
No, that's actually on the website. So what I did was when we took it out of the book, because it came back 750 pages, it's like, well, I'm going to take that section out. So when we put together the companion website, jamesbondlexicon.online, plug, that actually now has a mission statement and the storyline, the plot summaries are actually on the website now. So there's plot summaries of all the movies, comic books. I'm still adding the comic books, but all the movies are up there, all the novels are up there. And if we've done a podcast about the movie, there's links to all the various podcasts related to that movie as well. So all those mission summaries were originally in the book, but it was too much.
Oh, that would have been 1,000 pages, especially the comics, because we haven't delved on our show, we haven't delved too deeply into the newspaper strips. I think we did one episode where we picked a couple stories at random, but there are so many of those. And you were mentioning earlier, sometimes if something didn't make it into the final version of the book, it's because maybe that character didn't advance the plot. Uh-huh. And I remember for the few that I read, because I have a few of the Omnibus. I like them. They're fun. They're enjoyable. They're a quick, easy read. But it's true. Sometimes, someone will just show up and it's like, who's this person? Apparently it doesn't matter, because three squares later, they're not there anymore.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that in those newspaper strips. So I guess stuff had to be left on the cutting room floor. How has the feedback been generally so far? I know it's been out for, at the time of this recording, almost four weeks?
3 weeks.
So
our first review on Amazon, the day it came out.
Let's get into it.
Was a one-star review.
Come now. Seriously?
Seriously, yeah. I do know who it was from. I'm not going to name names. Who basically said the book was a complete waste of time because all it did was include stuff that's in the other books. It wasn't just an A to Z listing of stuff that was in the other books. I'm like, well, that's what the word lexicon means. It's right there on the title. So, but that one aside,
We didn't like the font either.
We didn't like the font either, yeah.
Or the layout.
But that one aside,
can't win them
all. It's been, yeah, people have been really good. We've had some really great feedback. Very positive feedback from most people. We started a little readers gallery section, which you're now in, Edgar, on the website. People have posted selfies of them with the book. There's a few nice pull quotes up there, including the one from you about it being, I forgot what it was, something thorough, painstakingly thorough, mind-blowingly thorough, or something.
Whatever. It sounds like something I would have said. But it's interesting.
Generally, the reception's been very, very good. We've been very pleased. Sales have been pretty brisk. So yeah.
Well, I'm happy to know that. And I think it's not really a question. It's more of a point of conversation. And the starting point would be the book you guys prepared, but also Mark's books and other books written by fan community members, if you will. It's not at the time of this recording, it's not out yet, but I know there's a From Tailors With Love book that's on the cusp of being published from Peter Brooker and Matt Spazer. I'm really getting the sense that the publishing houses and the powers that be that handle official publications, and we love the official publications. I got a whole library. It's all good. But the quality of the work that you two have put in, that Mark has put in, that Peter Brooker, Matt Spazer put in, I know, and Nicholas, I'm always butchering his last name, Nicholas Suschik.
In Argentina, I know who you mean. Yes.
Yeah. And the guy wrote one GoldenEye book, and then he wrote another guy. Oh, is this the same book? No, completely different book, but I'm talking about GoldenEye all over again, okay? The work the fans are putting in is, I gotta say, it's giving the official publications a solid run for their money. Like I'm getting this sense over the past 2-3 years since all of these books have come out that the fans are really, really putting in incredible effort into producing publications, whether it is publications or posters.
Some of the fan art posters are amazing.
Lee Bond's art, Sean Longmore. Look, we love James Bond, and we you know, the first order of business is give us more content, but it's also like, do a little bit better, please, because the fans are kind of outdoing you guys. I don't know what if you guys have that sentiment as well, but that's the vibe I've been having for about a year or two at this point.
I will agree with you about the posters. When you see some of the stuff that the fan arts, Ibrahim Mustafa's stuff that
stuff is brilliant. Yeah.
As you said, Ruben's stuff, some of the painted stuff, Jeffrey Marshall, there's a whole bunch of guys who do these amazing painted graphic, and then you see a badly photoshopped thing come out from
Daniel Kug, that looks like he's a deer cut in the headlights.
Trying
to get his gun out.
Yeah, yeah. From the studio, and you're like, really, you know, that's terrible, you know. The fans can produce the stuff, and I'm sure you can produce, pay people to produce stuff, and then they have the cheek to put out design a something for us competition, and we'll put your name out on social media. It's like, no, pay somebody to do it. You know, there are enough good, talented artists out there who want to work on this franchise. Pay somebody who can actually do it. Sorry, I'll get off that soapbox.
No, it's fine.
I think with the publications, I hear a lot of people saying self-publishing is easy. It's not easy. I've self-published a book. This is not self-published. This has actually gone through Van Allen Plexico's publishing company.
I noticed. I recognize the name there.
So this is, it says unofficial on the front. It is an unofficial book, but it's actually gone through a fully professional publishing process. We have a professional book designer design the interior pages, do the layout for us, which was not an easy task. He did it. There's a guy called Arnold Bloomberg. He did an amazing job actually taking all those pages of text and making it into a really beautiful looking book. And again, with the stuff that Mark's had published, great looking work. So, you know, I think there's a lot of heart and soul that people are putting into this, and they want to put quality product out there for the vast majority of cases. But yeah, there are a few I've seen where people have just, you know, cut and paste stuff from other articles and
yeah, you know,
done a self-published thing, and it's badly formatted and looks horrible. But but again, probably done with the best intentions. And I think this is just, the books that are coming out are a reflection of the vibrant Bond community that's out there. Unfortunately, you know, some of this stuff that's coming out is official stuff. It's nice. It's good to see it, but a lot of it just reads like PR speak. And they don't really dive into the details too much. But I mean, my day job's in marketing, so I totally get it. But I think sometimes it's just a little too clinically clean.
It's a little bit like that press junket, and it's sort of stage and.
Oh, as a marketing professional, my heart broke. I was in tears for that thing.
What's your favorite car, Daniel Craig?
And they weren't prepped at all, and it was just sloppy stuff.
I remember watching that. I think I went over to your place, Matt, like after
I think work,
we did a mini episode at your place, and it's just the strangest. I mean, look, we were flipping delighted. We were doing backflips. Just, oh my God, they started shooting a new Bond movie. You know, it was almost one of those things where it's like, yes, we have a new Bond movie. Thank you very much. That's all we needed. But then when you actually pay attention to the presentation of that thing, it's like.
Yeah, oh, and I remember when we announced the title of the last film. Wasn't that the film that you just did? Years ago, the last one.
Yeah.
Very, very. Bless their hearts. We love them with every bone and fiber in our bodies.
Speaking of fan created content, yeah, I know there are people that have published like their own sort of weird continuation novel. One of them that comes to mind was Bond Beyond, and was sort of mixing James Bond with the guy with the monster with the squid tentacle, Lovecraftian.
Lovecraft, yeah.
Bond with Lovecraft. Have you considered maybe adding some of? I figured, but I mean, it was.
To be honest, that was a decision that we talked about early on. Is with a project like this, even though it took 10 years, you've got to put boundaries around it. You're going to include, what you're not. So, you know, our thing was, it's got to be an officially licensed story or recognized by the licensing authorities as such, which is, you know, why the Roger Moore TV appearance as James Bond on the mainly Millicent TV show is in there, because it turned up on an Eon DVD. So therefore Eon recognized it. Therefore we put it in the book.
Because
in Canada now, of course, it's in the public domain. So we're starting to see a whole series of, continuation novels.
I don't know what I did with it, but yeah, I have a little short story collection.
Short story anthology. I have a copy of that. I bought in Canada. Mm. It was not bought in the US. So I have a copy of that as well. But yeah, so I was actually invited to contribute to that or pitch a story, but I decided not to. There's the unofficial sort of fan fiction type stuff that's out there. There's things like, you know, Bond turning up in some of the Marvel comics. He makes some cameo appearances. He's in the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, the Thomas Newman Dracula books. He's in there. Anno Dracula books. He's in there. We decided not to do those. A British secret agent who drives a silver sports car is in the Anno Dracula books, who is of Scottish ancestry. We decided not to include those, because again, where would you draw the line? It just go on and on and on. The 271 stories in here are all officially licensed stories either licensed by Ian Fleming Publications or Eon or other things like Never Say Never and Casino Royale 67. Mm. They are not unofficial movies. They're just made by, they're official, but made by somebody other than Eon. So
yeah, they're officially licensed. It's a little bit funny.
Yeah.
Are they not, Eon bought those back?
Yeah, but when they were made, they weren't.
Right, no,
yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, they got the distribution rights back through the whole MGM, Sony, I don't know. Complex.
Didn't someone try to sue them last time they released the box set and like Never Say Never Again wasn't included? Mm-hmm. So somebody tried to sue them.
And they, I think
they won, I believe.
They won.
In fact, it's that box set I can see behind you.
Oh, the Bond 50.
The Bond 50, yes. Yeah. Which was meant to be the complete James Bond. And it was, people were like, well, it doesn't have Never Say Never Again in it or Casino Royale 67, therefore, yeah.
Oh yeah, let's sue the pants off of them. False advertising. Good God. Was there anything else that I've used up all my questions?
Used up all your questions. I have one more, because there's a lot of content, a lot of stories you guys had to. I'm puzzled because there's stuff that's really, really rare, like the Moneypenny Diaries and some of the comics, especially the Dark Horse comics, is hard to get by. What is the story that, or the book, or whatever platform it was on, that you had to struggle the most to get a hold a copy of? There has to be one that you really had to.
Yeah.
Because we want copies too. So what do we
I was going to add, but yeah, we want your copy now.
Moneypenny. Yeah.
How much?
The two Moneypenny short stories.
But we were given them.
Oh,
so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, actually, we were given one by a friend who had a big James Bond collection and luckily had a copy.
Nice.
The other one, the one that first appeared in The Spectator, I ended up finding out who was the editor at The Spectator, emailing them, and they went to their archivist, and The Spectator actually eventually sent us a PDF of it. Now they're actually, I think it was earlier this year, they released all the Moneypenny book stories together as e-books, both the three books and the two short stories.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Oh, I'll buy that.
It's an e-book package. But yeah, those. And the other one was a kids series, can't remember the name of it. It's in the other room. I'd have to go grab it off.
Oh, is it that 003 and a half something? Or
No, not the 003 and a half. There was a, if only I had a book.
if only you had a book that had all that information.
Gave me that sort of stuff. But there was a kids book series where they advertised four, but they only ever published two.
Interesting.
And it took me ages to figure out that they'd actually only published the two. I was spending ages looking for the other two.
Oh, no.
And they were never ever published. But when you look on the back of the two that we got, again, from our friend who had the big Bond collection, it's actually got the covers of all four on the back. So it was like, well, these are the two, but they've never ever been published. But having said that, again, Mark Edlitz getting me in trouble. Mm-hmm. I now find from Mark Edlitz's book, there was James Bond Jr. Choose Your Own Fate adventure books, which I did not know about and are not covered in the lexicon. So I have to go and find those.
Burn this. Burn it.
I have to go find those and add them to the website. So we are new stuff that's coming out. Obviously, we can't put in the book. So any new stuff, new entries for like the new Dynamite comics, No Time to Die, whenever it comes out, the recent Comic Relief comic sketch with Daniel Craig, they're all going onto the James Bond lexicon.
The comic sketch.
Yeah,
sorry. It's true. He is playing James Bond in that.
He's playing James Bond. Yeah. So they're all on the companion website. So
that is deep, deep cut.
Let me put you, if you don't mind, Alan and Joe, if I can put you on the spot, since you both really don't like Skyfall or Spectre, you can only pick one: Skyfall, Spectre, or that stupid comedy sketch with Daniel Craig from a few weeks ago. One of them survives. The other two, you delete the hard drive.
Oh.
I would say Skyfall has to survive because of the cinematography and the music.
Interesting. 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 Very good.
I'd say Skyfall again. One, because as Jill said, the cinematography, I mean, it's beautiful looking film. I like Thomas Newman's soundtrack. And the other thing is, there's just so many things to talk about Skyfall and why it's bad. I'd get bored talking about Spectre. I hate that comedy sketch with it. It's just not worth talking about. But Skyfall, I could talk about for a long time. So.
Oh, yeah. It's the best Batman, I mean, James Bond movie. I was really excited for that thing because I had remembered the first time they collaborated where he's not playing James Bond, he's playing Daniel Craig, who has gotten the role of James Bond, and they sort of he falls in love with her. And I thought it was really funny. I was like, that's brilliant. This is fantastic. They're collaborating again. I can't wait. And I sat down on my couch to watch that thing and I did not smile once.
That was long and painful.
Yeah, that was a long 6 minutes.
Yeah,
jeez Louise, and
I don't know that I've actually seen
it. No, you haven't. I've spared you that. So
see, that's true love. That's true love.
Wonderful. But have you seen the not original? It's the new one's not a sequel to the other one. But have you seen their first collaboration from I guess about a decade ago or more than that? It's really good. It's really cool, Daniel.
I think you did it at the time when Catherine Tate and Daniel Craig for Comic Relief. I think you probably did.
Right.
I rewatched it because I had the same thing as you, because when I was doing the notes for this one to put on the website, I'm like, didn't they do an earlier one where he played James Bond? Did I miss that? So I went back and rewatched and it's like, oh no, he plays Daniel Craig. He doesn't play James Bond.
Yeah.
So. I like Saturday Night Live sketch that he did.
That's good too. I do like that.
That one was, he seems to have a great time at the casino. He's not sour or, it's funny.
Yeah, as we said earlier, this is not meant to be a Daniel Craig bashing session, but I really love him as an actor in other things. I love him. We love him in Knives Out. I think he's great in Logan Lucky.
He is good, man.
There's a lot of other. That's not just two of the more recent ones. A lot of his earlier stuff was really good too.
Apparently we're getting more of him in Knives Out. Yeah, didn't Netflix just pay like $500 million for
something? Yeah, it's like,
all right. So Daniel Craig was like, "Oh crap, what am I going to do after James Bond?"
Payday.
Yeah. I did like him in that quite a bit. It's a very good movie. That about right. Unless it was something about the book that you two need to get off your chest.
I just say where people can get it, find out stuff if you want. So the book, James Bond Lexicon, you can get it on all the global Amazon sites. And it's starting to pop up on some of the independent online bookstore sites as well. Right. We are maintaining a list of all the links on the companion website, which I've mentioned once or twice. Again, that's jamesbondlexicon.online. And you can follow us on Twitter @BondLexicon and on Instagram @JamesBondLexicon to keep up with everything we're doing with the book or just general James Bond stuff.
Yeah, I like the little strategy.
And of course, on Her Majesty's Secret Podcast Network as well for the James Bond shows. So I don't get told off by my co-hosts.
I don't know about you, Matt. My entry have you read the E chapter? E?
E?
I've
been getting weird texts on my watch during the show, so
that's the same. I don't know. Because there's an entry here everywhere.
Everywhere.
what M. White yells at Matt and Edgar at the end of every episode. We have people everywhere.
We have people everywhere. I have to stop doing that.
Sorry. I know this is not your fault, Alan and Joe. He somehow has corrupted my
Amazon.
It only took 2 days to get here, but I don't know.
Distribution center. He's everywhere.
We do have people everywhere. We got www.jamesbondcomplex.com. We're on Instagram, which I've actually been contributing to a little bit. At the James Bond Complex. We're on Twitter @TheBondComplex. Facebook, search for the James Bond Complex. YouTube, search for the James Bond Complex. Subscribe and tickle us with the thumbs up button. We're hosted at anchor.fm. You can also download us on Spotify, Google Podcasts, some random Quebec Francophone website, which I don't understand what we're doing on that. But we're ranked pretty highly, though.
I think I sent them the link years ago, like when we started.
And Apple, search for the James Bond Complex, subscribe, write a review. And just like for the James Bond Lexicon, leave us a 5-star glowing golden gun review.
Definitely. I mean, if it's a highly recommended, this book.
It's stunning. You know, it's not the type of thing where you like, oh, I'm going to sit down and read this from the front cover to the back, but it's such a glorious.
It's you know, you just pick a page and start reading. The chef.
I know. It's a labor of love, and we want to thank you, Alan and Joe, not just for being on the show this evening, but for, I mean, honestly, for producing this book. Thank you 1,000 times. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having us on the show. It's been really
thank
fun.
You. It was fun.
Absolute pleasure. And just as James Bond always returns, so too will the James Bond Complex with. Whatever, I don't have the schedule in front of me. Something's coming next Wednesday. Sur ce, toujours un plaisir. À la prochaine.
Au revoir.
Arigato matane.